Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And it is Monday, August 20th, 2018. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Monday, Melody.
Happy Monday to you, too. And let's see, let's go ahead and go to the gold prices today. And we have gold up another $5.20 today, and we're at $11.90, ladies and gentlemen. One day at a time, $1 at a time, or $5 at a time. $11.90 for gold today, up $5.20. Silver still a little pressure, down 4 cents at $14.83, but it had a bigger day on Friday. Platinum was up $6 today at $798, and palladium was up 10 at $924. The USDX today was down 0.20 at 95.91. Crude oil was up 58 cents at 66.47. Didn't have the chance to follow the markets today. I saw an early morning trade. They were up, so I figured what was the point to follow the paper markets. And the Dow was up 89 points today, off its highs, though, 25,758. The NASDAQ was up 7,821, and the S&P was up 6, 2,871. And, oh, for Pete's sake, I just saw this. Oh, I'm just so sick of the mainstream media. I'll tell you what, they are the enemy of the public, the people, for when it comes to gold. They truly are. 10-year yield up, down 0.05 at 2.82%. Let's see if there's anything else interesting going on. A little pressure on Bitcoin, not a whole lot. Dave, I believe everyone is in anticipation of perhaps the record, the big bull market. It's a 9-year run since it's, the...
Yep.
It's going to be 3,453 days old. And we have... but you know what's interesting? When I was reading about that earlier in the day, it still didn't do... The S&P didn't do in this 9-year bull run as what it did in the 90s. With that run in the 90s, it went up 400%. Now we're up only a little over 300%. So still not as but certainly we'll have a little bit of a birthday party on March, on not March, but this Wednesday. So
don't it'll be the out. End of the bull run.
It'll be the end of the bull run. You got it.
We'll be celebrating.
Yes, yes. And the beginning of gold. Well, gold's been in a bull market ever since, for a while. But anyway, let's go ahead and let's talk a little bit. I saw President Trump talked a little bit about Turkey today, and I didn't have a chance to watch his press conference. I guess that's what you'd want to call it. And but the S&P took Turkey's sovereign debt rating even lower on Friday. This was, of course, after this information came out after the our program on Friday. The S&P had already rated Turkey's bonds as junk, and then lowered the long-term foreign currency sovereign credit rating just one notch to a B+, and the long-term to BB-. The credit rating firm also forecasts a recession for Turkey next year, but a junk bond is anything rated BB or lower by the agency, and it's considered a high-risk investment. A bond credit rating indicates its creditworthiness. It helps investors assess whether or not the debt will be repaid.
It's true. You know, the S&P projected that Turkey's economy will shrink next year and said the current weakening has a negative fiscal implication, including straining corporate balance sheets in Turkey and putting a lot more pressure on its banks. Now, as we've been reporting, Turkey's lira has lost more than 40% of its value against the dollar in 2018, And that sparked fears of, a sell-off in all the emerging markets, especially if Turkish officials moved to introduce capital controls. Currency took a 20% hit again last Friday, that after President Trump announced the doubling of steel and aluminum tariffs on Turkey, that in retaliation for the country's refusal to release American pastor Andrew Brunson. As we know, relations between the U.S. and Turkey took another turn for the worse this week as the White House threatened more economic sanctions again over the issue of handing over Brunson. Turkey's President Erdogan has been criticized for not allowing its central bank enough independence to raise interest rates. Where have we heard that before? Despite an overheating economy and inflation now exceeding 15%. And that's three times more than the central bank's target of 5%, Melody.
Well, you know, this morning, the Trump administration rejected a proposal from Turkey. And that proposal from Turkey would free Brunson in exchange for relief of one of its largest banks. The report had said Turkey had asked the U.S. to drop an ongoing investigation into Halkbank, one of the biggest state-owned Turkish banks. And the bank faces major fines for, alleging violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. So in exchange, the Turkish government would release Brunson. And, if we would help out one of their banks, the biggest bank. But the White House official said other issues concerning U.S.-Turkey relations will not be discussed until after Brunson is released. A real NATO ally wouldn't have arrested Brunson in the first place.
Yeah, that's pretty blunt talk. There's a broad cross-section of U.S. businesses which have a message for the administration, and that is new tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports will force Americans to pay more for items they use throughout their daily lives, from cradles to coffins. 6 days of public hearings on the proposed duties of up to 25% are starting. Actually, they're underway today as we speak in Washington. That's part of President Trump's and U.S. trade representatives' efforts to pressure Beijing for sweeping changes to its trade and economic policies. Previous rounds of U.S. tariffs, as we know, sought to shield consumers by targeting Chinese industrial machinery, as well as electronic components and other intermediate goods. Now, thousands of consumer products could be directly hit by the new tariffs by the end of September, just a little over a month away.
Well, I was reading an interesting article today, and I was going to put it in our newsletter. Perhaps it'll go in next week. And it was talking about China's manufacturing and how there's a lot of businesses that have been doing business there for 30 years, and now they're coming to the conclusion that they're looking to leave China, not only because of China's regulations. Now they're beginning to clamp down on pollution, having a little more regulations on that, but they're moving their manufacturing to Taiwan, Vietnam, a lot of these other places that have yet to really take off. There were some that were talking about coming back to the States, and these are U.S. manufacturers that are, that have businesses and manufacturing plants in China. So it's kind of like we're seeing this whole area of manufacturing relocating and it does look like we'll be getting some back, because that's what the one gentleman was saying, now with the price that it's costing us, we're going to have to do something. It's not as easy as it once was. Because China also wants to concentrate on technology. They want to move more into a more of a service economy like ours and so forth. And I found that interesting that, that China wouldn't fight tooth and nail to keep the manufacturing. They have done some things to keep some of it, you know, by giving them like 8 years of no taxes and things like that, so subsidies and so forth, you know, to try to keep them there. But and I just thought it was interesting to see how some of these business people that own manufacturing companies over there, you know. But there's been talk for years that they've been looking, that manufacturing companies were looking to relocate out of China. So,
yeah, what I'm hearing in that respect, Melody, has been that, you know, some Chinese officials are beginning to hear more and more from a growing, louder segment of its younger population who want cleaner air and cleaner water. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fighting City Hall is a tad different in a more of a closed shop like China as compared to the U.S., where often it's hard enough. But, you know, that could be creating some pushback by some of these American manufacturing companies, you know, who are hearing from, you know, their employees who are centered there. You know, that's particularly outside of the major cities, which, you know, you see pictures, particularly in the hot, hazy summer days. It just is cloudy as all get out. So,
You know, it's we are to be blessed. I mean, all the problems that we think we have here. I have a client that called me from China on Friday. And he said to me, he says, "Well, what's going on?" I was like, "Well, what do you, you know?" Because I just didn't, you know. And he's been in, see, the last time he was in the States was early July, you know. So he's been over there a little over a month, and he says, "What's going on?" I'm thinking, "Well, you're on the internet all the time." He says, "Melody," he says, "you know, what you find in the States, you have it at your disposal. You can find information in minutes." He says that same information that takes you minutes to find, it takes us, that same information, it takes us weeks. He says weeks. And so, you know, it's we are very fortunate to have at our disposal so many of the conveniences that the rest of the world is striving to achieve for their countries and so forth. But because you don't think of it in that terms, you think of these, you see these huge cities that are, you know, you talk about all this technology, but you forget that the difference of the governments, and they don't allow their people. It's not that they don't have access. It's not that they don't have the technology and the infrastructure. Is they don't allow their people to have it. But so going back to the 200 billion list on the Chinese targets, I think we mentioned these ones before: seafood, furniture, lighting products, tires, chemicals, plastic, bicycles, and car seats for babies. There's an additional 200 billion of Chinese imports, dramatically expands the harm to American consumers, workers, and businesses to the economy. And this was a written testimony for this hearing by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The top U.S. business lobbying group said the administration lacks a coherent strategy to address China's theft of intellectual property and other harmful trade. And it goes on and on and on.
Yeah. I mean, 1,400 written comments in all submitted to the U.S. trade rep, many of which will likely be echoed in these hearings this week on Capitol Hill. You know, you got them ranging from Graco children's products, you know, car seats, the swings, portable play yards. You got Ebb and Flow feeding, saying the tariffs will hit manual breast pumps. And, you know, the other end of the cycle, you got Centennial Casket, who says, Chinese, they rely exclusively on Chinese made caskets. He said the tariffs are going to cause great loss for his company and employees. And then there's Huffy, the U.S. bicycle brand, which apparently said the tariffs is going to pose a serious threat to that company's future. So it, you know, it, we're hearing from many sectors right now, and this week will be interesting to see what all this noise on Capitol Hill, you know, how that translates into the talks between the U.S. and some of its trading partners, including China, which may or may not happen this week. We shall see, Melody.
Well, I don't know if I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but, you know, these people with these companies, these CEOs and owners of these companies, it's like, you know what? Step up to the pump. You've gotten away. You've made billions of dollars in the past 30 years. So, you know, yes, it's going to trickle down, and you know, the consumer is the one who's actually going to pay for it, and you know, the consumer will, you know, eventually stop consuming to the degree, because they might put off purchases longer and so forth until they, of course, I'm really talking about the American consumer, and we know that we don't do that, or they don't do that. But you know, to hear all this whining and crying about these companies and these tariffs, it kind of, you know what? I don't have a whole lot of, you know.
Sounds like you'll be interested in hearing a story we have on a new proposal in the U.S. Senate we're going to talk about in the third segment, the Capitalism Accountability Act, which could prove to be an interesting topic if it... if it goes anywhere, which is unlikely this year, but certainly sets up the table for a discussion next year, depending on the outcome of the midterm elections in November. Mm.
But, yeah, all right, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. You have to stay until that third segment.
But, absolutely.
We mentioned this briefly on Friday about a trade deal with Mexico, a new trade deal, a new... Canada's not quite in it yet, is it? Or did they join in since Friday?
No, not that I'm aware of. No, we hear that the administration's economic advisor Kevin Hassett said this morning that Canada is going to want in on the trade deal, that the U.S. negotiators are supposedly on the verge of coming to terms on with Mexico. Hassett said we're even closer to reaching a deal with Mexico after Mexican negotiators were in D.C. for most of last week. Now, Canada has not been part of these most recent talks to rework the 24-year-old NAFTA, but Hassert, for one, thinks that after we close the deal with Mexico, that Canada is going to look at it and see some of the stuff they like and maybe some stuff they want to get in on. But in any event, he says it's going to make it a lot easier to make a deal with Canada because we got a deal with Mexico. But let's see the deal first.
Yeah. Devil's in the details. And we're heading into a break right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. Thank you for joining and listening to Financial Survival.
We will find you acting on your best.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. I just want to finish up heading into the break. We're talking about, perhaps the talks, or we're getting close to an agreement with Mexico. And, from when I was hearing and so forth, it was like they were really close. But yet on Thursday, you had the U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer say he expressed hope for a breakthrough with Mexico soon. And Trump, alongside Lighthizer, said he was in no rush to conclude talks on NAFTA, which started about a year ago, and has missed deadline after deadline. So these talks are moving slowly and stalled in the run-up to the July 1st presidential election in Mexico. But I heard they really wanted to finish this up before the new president came in, Obrador. So I thought that's what I was reading. And they only have, like, I don't know, there's a time frame tacked onto it, like 90 days, I believe, that anything that is signed by this president has to be done so many days before the new president takes effect, so he can't make changes to it. So so we'll see if they get that done prior to his inauguration and taking over the position.
Mixed signals, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, we talked about it back a couple of months ago, about Venezuela introducing a new crypto-backed currency because of the horrendous shape of their economy. That's taken a step forward today, as a part of its attempt to stop its skyrocketing inflation. The country's issuing a new fiat currency called the Sovereign Bolivar, which will be backed by its own cryptocurrency. That crypto, called Petro, doesn't trade, and Venezuela's own parliament says it's being used illegally to mortgage the nation's cash-strapped oil reserves. Steve Hanke, who's a professor of economics at Johns Hopkins, and one of the world's leading experts on hyperinflation, which certainly is the tune of the day in Venezuela, says this is a smoke and mirrors operation typical of Venezuela, Melody. He says, "I'll believe it when I see it."
Well, Dave, this weekend, and I guess this coincides with the introduction of that, Bloomberg reported that he had actually carried out one of the greatest currency devaluations in history.
Maduro,
95% plunge, and it's going to test the capacity of an already beleaguered population to stomach even more pain. I mean, we talked about the inflation is forecasted to reach a 1,000,000% this year. It's going to get some fresh fuel from these measures. Prices are currently rising at an annual rate of 108,000%. And this is according to Bloomberg's Café con Leche Index. Massive exodus deaths of Venezuelans fleeing the crisis to neighboring countries will likely increase. And, of course, tensions and restrictions come along with that. And, you know, you just see pictures. Everything is being burned out and so forth. Oh. I heard over there that one carrot will cost like $10, $12 in U.S. Today's, who knows what it might be tomorrow.
It's awful.
It is.
Did you say about his action on Friday about the minimum wage? Did I miss that? He announced Maduro announced a 3,000% hike in their minimum wage.
Yes.
That new currency kicks in today. We're just seeing opposition.
And that's equivalent to about $30 a month.
Is that right?
$30 a month is that minimum wage.
Well, Maduro certainly has his work cut out for him there with, opposition leaders calling for a nationwide strike and all the protests in the streets that you mentioned. With the collapsing currency and these food shortages, things are apt to get worse there before they get better.
And I don't know. You know, I don't know. What can he do? What do you do? You just let it. I mean, somebody has to come to the rescue.
Yeah, you know, I'd send an emissary to the U.S. You know, try and get us to back down on our sanctions. You know, I'm not sure what effect they're having, but they certainly aren't helping. But I'm sure they're, you know, any pressure relief. Is going to help. And then, you know, I think they got to go to the IMF see what kind of package, they can work out there.
I wonder if they, I was reading also about how, you know, all these shock measures that have been announced by Maduro, how it's going to sit with the military. You have top-ranking generals that have been handed the keys to ministries, the state-run oil company, the lucrative business of food imports. You have a myriad of exchange rates created juicy arbitrage opportunities. And so supposedly this is all going to hit Maduro's popularity. And it's been, you know, but power is being sustained with bullets and not votes. So, you know, he's got to... as long as the military continues to have access to lucrative businesses, it's going to continue to grant support to the government.
You know, as Johnny Carson's alter ego, what was his name? Somebody the Magnificent. someone who could tell see the future. I see another refugee crisis in our future, not necessarily ours as in the U.S., but ours in the world's, unless that country can start to turn things around.
Yeah, so, you know, the regime change is what everybody wants, but hey, as long as he's got the military on his side, he's not going anywhere. So, I don't know. So you get a $30 a month raise, you can buy 3 carrots.
God. Bless.
You can buy 3 carrots.
Yep.
Well, this with the average American's debt, you have credit cards, student loans, mortgages, car loans, personal loans.
Wee-haw!
I want to go shopping. Most Americans have a combination of these sources of debt, and despite their best intentions, you know, we have the American consumer is just digging themselves deeper into a hole each year. The average American now has about almost 40 grand in debt, 38,000. That's up 1,000 from a year ago. It doesn't seem like a lot, you know, $1,000 from a year ago. This report also revealed that fewer people said they carry no debt this year compared to 2017, 23% versus 27%. Is this good? Is this bad? You have credit. Dave?
Go ahead.
You have credit cards and mortgages that are tied as a leading source of debt, followed by you have student loans and car loans.
Well, you know, the survey breaks this down by generation. Melody, and the Gen Z, the youngest generation, and the younger millennials aged 18 to 24 have an average debt of 22,000. You know, for those aged 18 to 24, it's, you know, no surprise that student loans are, you know, the biggest source of debt. That's at roughly 6,200, which is, you know, between, I guess, a quarter and a third of their total debt. And that's followed by credit card balances. You know, at least experts consider student loans to be good debt because they're typically lower cost, and some have tax advantages. Credit card debt's almost always bad debt because it has much higher interest rates and no deductibility on your taxes anymore. Now, older millennials age 25 to 34 have 42,000 in debt. Now, that's almost double the younger millennials and the Gen Zs. You know, among the older millennials, credit card balances are the leading source of debt, making up a full fourth of what they owe. Student debt accounts for about 16%, while mortgages make up just 3%, probably because they're just getting into that market of owning a home.
And, of course, this debt doesn't include our government debt, does it?
It does.
Well, much, much more. Much, much more. Baby boomers, those that are 50 and older, owe $36,000. So, which probably isn't very good for those that are retiring. Hopefully those that are retiring at least are, you know, have no debt at all. But a third of baby boomers have less than $25,000 put away for their golden years. And meaning that they're going to end up working longer than they planned. And, of course, we talked about Friday about the unfunded pension plans and the liabilities and what they're doing. We're Philadelphia. Can you believe this? Because they own a power company. Was it a gas company or a power company?
Philadelphia Gas Works, yeah.
Gas Works, yeah. If you don't pay your gas bill, they come and put liens on your house.
Yep. 3 months or $300.
Yeah.
They ain't messing around.
They're not messing.
But where does that collection, those millions of dollars in arrears collected, go? To their pension funds to pay off those incredibly high unfunded liabilities, pay for some of the fund managers and whatnot. It's a city that whose taxpayers have been caught by surprise, it sounds like. You got to wonder how long it'll take for the grassroots there to rise up and say, whoa, come on now.
I know, it's truly incredible. Pennies, we haven't heard about Pennies or Sears for a while, Dave.
Well, you know, as we've been reporting regularly, you know, the world of retail has been in a state of disruption for many years now, particularly from fourth quarter of last year through, you know, really through the present. Brick and mortar retailers have been fighting the e-commerce leaders, and the so-called multi or omni-channel offerings by the big retailers are creating a lot of winners and some rather large losers. Now, it's without any real arguments that JCPenney and Sears Holding Company, you know, have been and continue to be disasters, financial, that is. You know, in some ways, these two companies have experienced, I like this characterization, of high-altitude engine flameouts. It might seem fitting to wonder which company ultimately may fail first. But between now and then, many observers are asking which of these two fallen retail giants will become a classic penny stock first.
Yeah.
It's not a good choice there, Melody. Things do not look bright.
Well, you know, they'll probably end up closing even more stores after already having tried that move in prior years. It also could find itself among the most shorted New York Stock Exchange. The stocks, and that's a JCPenney. So,
yeah, it's just not exciting. Very little curb appeal at either store. You know, and the experience in its stores. You know, many people, You honestly feel like, you know, what would happen if you left the store without any remodeling for a couple of more decades. That's sad to say. Did anyone even notice, you know, Sears further branching out into e-commerce after it announced that, you know, it was going to close 63 Sears and Kmart stores late last fall, early this spring? And S&P, we're reading, believes that Sears may already be in default on some of its debt. So things don't look good there, Melody.
No, they don't. And I just want to say one more thing about tariffs today, and then we got a couple minutes here left before we go into the third segment. One more thing about tariffs today. You have U.S. business economists. They're all saying how these tariffs are going to slow the economy along with higher budget deficits. And I really think this is the biggest problem, the budget deficits. And I think this is all going to be, everybody's going to be shocked here come September when we begin to dive more into the numbers and the numbers are released. And perhaps the media will actually talk about it. Who knows? Of course, they're not going to talk about anything if it's going to hurt the precious Wall Street. But I think you have more than 90% of economists surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics. So they think that the tariffs are going to hurt the economy. And, Dave, I think everybody knows that prices are going to rise here in the United States, and therefore people are going to cut back on their spending and so forth. But, you know, if the tariffs are depending on how bad it can hurt the economy, you know, it's just like we've seen and we've heard of some businesses that have been affected by the tariffs already. They're willing to hurt a little bit because they think it's good for the country. And we've had other presidents who decided to use tariffs and so forth, but they were easily talked out of their position, you know, and they would reverse them. This administration, this president is not budging. He's staying the program, and it could be good in a long term, but in the meantime, we will experience pain, and that's what we've been saying for day in and day out. You know, whether the tariffs, so you can argue that these tariffs are going to hurt the economy, but is it good for the country at this point in time when we're seeing, countries got to go out there and they got to grab their economies. They got to grab the work in order to keep the people working. So this is the businesses, 7 in 10 of the economists that were surveyed said they thought the tax cuts enacted in December were they were too stimulative because of the resulting increase in the national debt, even though 2/3 of the corporate tax cuts generally benefit their companies.
Yeah, just a minute before we hit our next break, but, you know, 80% also told survey takers that, you know, the administration's effort to ease regulations would boost growth in the short run. But, you know, as a whole, the responses of the business economists represent a rebuke of our current overall approach to the economy.
I don't know how long it'll take until we know the impact of the tariffs. We really don't even know which ones are active or not. 800-375-4188. We'll be back in just a few short minutes. Please stay tuned, and thank you for listening to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. And you can visit us on the web at dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And call us at 1-800-375-4188. We have the 90% 50 cent pieces, little 20, those bags are real popular, $25 face value of the 50 cent pieces, and you can buy one bag or 100 bags. We have plenty, and I'm still trying to purchase a lot of the AUBU, but that's, you know, I got $30 face here. I can't buy it in full bags like I was there for a period of time, but as soon as it's available again, we will sell that. But this is, I like the 50 cent pieces because they're lightly circulated, so you get a nice coin. So give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. Dave, you wrote about, and I mentioned this because I came across an article, and it was, I mean, you hear this thrown around, constitutional convention, and I don't know if other radio programs are talking about it and so forth. You know, you hear about it, it's thrown about and so forth. No one pays much attention to it. And but the article I was reading, I was kind of really shocked at the time frame that that these people are trying to accomplish this. I mean, this is, now I might be mistaken, but this seems like it has an agenda. There's a time frame that's being heavily pushed. Am I correct? But you wrote an article about it, and it's in our newsletter today, and it's a constitutional convention that's actually close to being convened by the states. So I was surprised.
You're not the only one, Melody. You know, listeners, this is a longer segment than you're used to hearing from us, but please stick with us. I think you'll find what we're going to talk about rather compelling. You know, over 230 years ago, the founding fathers came together at Independence Hall in Philadelphia for the first constitutional convention. That was to turn our infant nation's shared values and principles into our Constitution. You know, that collective vision became reality in 1789, less than a year after New Hampshire became the ninth colony to ratify it. The Bill of Rights was subsequently ratified in 1791, as states approved 10 of the 12 constitutional amendments that were swiftly passed and sent to them by the first Congress. Since then, more than 11,700 constitutional amendments have been proposed in Congress. Only 15 of them, for a total of 27, have been approved and later ratified by at least three-quarters of the states, the minimum required. And they are now a part of the longest-living written constitution in existence on Earth today. Now, fast forward to 2018. When a well-funded, highly coordinated, and shockingly quiet, under-the-radar national effort, actually efforts, is underway to convene another constitutional convention, just as Melody said at the outset. For the first time in our history, states are using Article 5 of the Constitution to convene a convention that would, in theory, allow a complete overhaul of our founding document as amended over the years. Two of those pushes are coming largely from the right, so to speak, with one calling for an open convention of states to limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and the other calling only for a balanced budget amendment. A third push is being spearheaded mainly by the left to overturn the 2010 Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court by eliminating corporate personhood, as it's called, and requiring publicly financed elections. Supporters of the balanced budget amendment convention are close to succeeding, with narrow special interest groups leading the way with money, regardless of how you feel about the issue itself. Activists are just five states shy of reaching the constitutionally required 34-state goal for that convention.
You know, that whole area, that's the problem I have, interest groups. I have the Article 5 of the Constitution in front of me, Dave. Here's what it says. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by the conventions in three-fourths thereof. So what's the big deal about a constitutional convention, Dave?
Well, I mean, regardless how you feel about the stated purpose or purposes for calling, you know, an Article 5 convention, a second constitutional convention poses major, and in my opinion anyway, unacceptable risks, especially in our current polarized political climate. I mean, precious few Americans are even aware that a constitutional convention can be called through Article 5, let alone that the process to call one has been underway for some time and is being underwritten by a handful of the nation's wealthiest people on both sides of the political spectrum. And few know that, irrespective of your political leanings and how strongly you may support or oppose some of these proposed amendments, there would be virtually no checks on the scope and the reach of such a convention. You know, in just the past 3 years, the so-called Open Convention of States resolution has passed 12 states and has been introduced in 37 more.
Well, you know, and you're right about one thing. And again, we're back to the lobbyists who's running this, and we all know this is not the time because it's not going to benefit us. We know this. Mm. So what's your opinion? Why is this convention such a bad idea?
Well, as our buddy Shakespeare would say, let us count the ways. You know, and there are many of them. Let me mention what I think are the five most important reasons. First, the possibility of unequal representation. You know, it's unclear how states would even choose delegates to make decisions, debate, discuss, and act in such a convention, how states and citizens would be represented. And no one could be sure who ultimately would get the vote on the issues raised at a convention. Just the convention delegates, state legislative bodies, Congress, voters at a special election across the country. Second, there's the lack of convention rules, sort of related to number one. There are no rules governing constitutional conventions, which would make an Article 5 convention and just an unpredictable Pandora's box. I mean, the last and only one to date, 1787, was called to amend the Articles of Confederation. But as we know, it led to a brand new constitution. Not necessarily a bad thing, as it turns out, but, you know, one group advocating for a convention of states is promoting the idea of using the process to undo hard-won civil rights and civil liberties on the one hand, and on the other hand, another group would like to eliminate the Second Amendment and mandate taxpayer-paid health care for all. You know, convention rules, which would be written on the fly at the convention, could be manipulated to favor one party, one region of the country, or one interest group over another. I mean, as we know, and we'll see in a second, you know, money does talk. and minority protections, which are so central to the Constitution's guarantees, could be trampled upon. I mean, sparsely populated states could impose their will on the majority Americans who live in densely populated ones, or vice versa. And three, the threat of a runaway convention. Here's where the rubber meets the road, and this is probably the biggest risk, Melody. There's nothing in Article 5 or elsewhere to stop a constitutional convention once convened from being expanded in scope to issues not raised in resolutions passed by state legislatures. And that could lead to a runaway convention where virtually any part of the Constitution could be changed or even eliminated. For example, I mean, convention delegates could end presidential term limits, or our constitutional republic could be replaced with another form of government altogether, such as a parliamentary system. You know, although it's probably unlikely that, you know, the required 38 states would subsequently have, you know, approve such drastic changes, you know, you could argue that it's already amazing that so many states have taken the initial steps of calling for one. We're not even sure if, you know, three quarters of the states would have to approve the convention's work for it to become the new law of the land. You know, that's how the Constitution currently is written. The 1787 Constitutional Convention ditched pre-existing ratification rules. So who's to say an Article 5 convention couldn't or wouldn't? In fact, nearly everything about this powerful process would be uncertain. Number four, what you mentioned earlier, not to be taken lightly, the influence of special interests. An Article 5 convention would open the Constitution to revisions at a time of extreme gerrymandering across the country, polarization amid unprecedented, unlimited political spending. It, you know, most scary, I think, it could allow special interests, especially wealthiest Americans on both sides of the political spectrum, to rewrite the rules governing our system of government. And five, you know, that all could lead to the threat of legal battles. You know, no judicial, legislative, or executive body would have clear authority to settle disputes about this convention. And that would open up the process to chaos, expensive, protracted legal battles, you know, division that would threaten the functioning of our republic and economy.
So who are the ones that are pushing for this convention?
Huh. Well...
Who isn't?
Well, first, think about this. Over 230 so far, public interest, government reform, civil rights, labor, environmental, immigration, constitutional rights organizations on the right and left have publicly opposed calls for an Article 5 constitutional convention. And yet it will come as no surprise to our listeners that once again, money speaks loud and clear. The answer to your question of who's pushing for a constitutional convention, I think that can only be found by answering who's financing the push. And that answer in two words, Koch and Soros. As in, the Koch brothers on the right and George Soros on the left. You know, we know, for example, libertarian billionaire bros Charles and David Koch, they've long opposed federal power and federal spending. You know, they've created a massive $400 million campaign finance network fueled by their fortunes and those of their wealthy allies. And that network rivals, you know, the two major political parties. The Koch's American for Prosperity says it supports a balanced budget convention. It's opposed an open convention, calling it problematic. But whatever qualms the Koch's might have, Melody, they continue to be a bedrock funder of the entire convention movement. Now, you know, running the Convention of States Initiative, as it's called, the Convention of States Initiative, CSI, it's an Austin, Texas-based nonprofit called Citizens for Self-Governance. And that organization reported almost $6 million in 2015 alone, more than double its haul from 2 years earlier when it launched the Convention of States project. You know, and the group isn't required to disclose its donors, but, you know, research into other organizations' tax records by others shows, you know, a web of Koch-linked groups having provided over $5 million to CSG from the group's founding in 2011 through 2015.
And what about Soros?
Well, on the other side sits billionaire and former hedge fund manager George Soros. He's a self-professed liberal and considered to be one of the most successful investors of all time.
Crook. That's, you mean crook.
Well, yeah, maybe I choose my words loosely.
Scum.
We won't get into this, but
no, go ahead.
He made $1 billion in one day back in the early 90s by shorting the English pound.
But he created it. He created the situation so he could.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And since then, he's been a well-known and controversial supporter of American, largely American, progressive causes and Democratic Party candidates, including more recently Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now, as far back as the 2003-04 election cycle, he reportedly donated over $23 million to the Center for American Progress and other groups supporting John Kerry in his bid to defeat then-President George W. Bush. Who successfully won re-election. Although it's unclear exactly how much Soros has dug into his pockets to push for, you know, a constitutional conventions, it's undoubtedly millions, if not tens of millions of dollars, with the express purpose of overturning Citizens United. But beyond that, who knows? I mean, he's reportedly, if not A, then the major financier of this Move to Amend Coalition, which is a broad umbrella organization of hundreds of organizations, such as the Alliance for Democracy, Center for Media and Democracy, which is a big Soros-funded media group, and the Sierra Club, and that's just to mention a few. The Move to Amend's mission states that it's committed to social and economic justice, ending corporate rule, and building a vibrant democracy. So you got to believe, Melody, that, if there were to be a convention convened, that, he too would use his wherewithal to see his way.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about this. We're going to finish this up, but you can go to our website, dgscoins.com, get our weekly newsletter, and find this information article written by Dee Fallon. So I'll be back tomorrow with Greg Hunt. And until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Dreams, I have a plan. If I got me